All right. Well, welcome back to the Clydesdale Chronicle. We have episode number 4. I'm super excited because this is probably one of the people that I grew up with, have a lot of respect for. We are sitting down with Kathy Bain and going to be talking about just how they got started. If you don't know, like, my family's been in the industry forever, and my dad and Kathy go way back and talks about the early days. So, Kathy, do you want to talk about how you got into the Clydesdale breed? I mean, you're so passionate, but where did this start?
Well, I love talking about how we got started because I love where we started and I love where we're at today. But before I was born, which was a long time ago, my parents rented a farm in Pecatonica, Illinois, from Mr. Floyd Conger, who had wonderful Clydesdale horses. And my parents went there to farm. They went there to milk cows, and they had hogs, and they did all the land work. But they also took care of Mr. Conger's Clydesdale horses. And I don't ever remember Mr. Conger being anything but an older gentleman who needed help. He couldn't hear, he could stumbled, you know. But his family didn't want to continue with his breed. So when Mr. Conger died, then we bought the farm, and my parents bought out the Clydesdale horses. And so then the Groves family got involved at that point.
So that's the farm you're currently on was the same farm that Floyd Conger's
was? I was born on that farm.
Wow.
And I remember, you know, Mr. Conger would come. I'd get off the school bus, and Mom would say, go out and help Floyd do the chores. And I couldn't even change my clothes before he was out at the barn. And Mr. Conger had very, very good horses.
Yeah.
He was a hitch guy, totally a hitch guy. Didn't want to breed anything. But his passion was in the show ring. So we still have that farm. My parents lived there. When my dad died, my mom had a lot to do on the farm, and my family was there to help. Andy, my oldest son, was a young man at that point, but he decided that he would like to buy the front part of Mom's farm, and that's when the Bain brothers came into partnership, because the boys and John and I as silent partners. I'm not always a silent partner, but I try.
I could never be fucking silent.
So I try to be that, but that's when the partnership came in to play. Now, my parents set them up with, I said when we bought the herd, we bought the good, the bad, the ugly. You know, we all have those horses at home that aren't marketable. They're old. And the boys were young. And two of them, Logan and Ryan, were still in school.
Yeah.
And Andy, you know, bought the farm. So we were lucky enough to buy out. At that point, we just had a breeding farm. I grew up hitching horses with my dad and Mr. Conger, and my dad got ill, so then we got done hitching and only had a breeding farm. And then when the boys bought the partnership out, they my mom bought them a set of harness, and they said, Mom, we want to get back into this play too, plus have their breeding farm. So we started back out, you know. All the leather halter was dry rotted, and we didn't have a good wagon, and we didn't have what we needed, but we just started. They walked, and then now we're have a mare 6 horse hitch that we're really proud of.
That you've built up, and every little by little by little.
Right.
Like, I've seen the wagon you started with, and then now you've got a different wagon. And you started first when you kind of started back driving. I remember you guys had a team of home raised mares that were just incredible. And that you had, I think it was a wagon that was made out of Wisconsin. I can't remember the guy's name.
Harley Stevenwood made that wagon.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And now you've upgraded the wagon even more. And then you've got a full 6 horse hitch.
So even as a 4 generation family, I think you kids can relate that your business always changes and grows. And we can't quit growing and thinking of growth and still stay in it. So we are fortunate enough that our breeding program has been good. And so we drive our breeding program pretty much. When I look at our 6, I'm really proud of them. And I'm proud that they're all carrying a baby that will have the Glencoe prefix on it.
Mm-hmm. So explain that. You still have the Glencoe prefix. How did the Glencoe prefix come about?
So that was a painful, long process, and my parents would laugh when I speak of this. So the prefixes, as you all know, through the association, you can register a prefix. Every baby that is born on your farm will have that prefix, and it does give you a lot of notoriety.
It's your best advertising.
It is, and it's a tradition. So Mom and Dad decided long ago they wanted a prefix, but they couldn't agree on one. And Mom and Dad had taken a couple trips to Scotland, and that was their, my mom called it their happy place. They loved those trips. So they got the Scotland map out, and they were looking at places in Scotland. And they saw Glencoe, and that kind of sparred them. Everybody doesn't remember Glenn Thurston from Utah, but he had, you know, like we got our first Jasper horse from Glenn Thurston. Mm-hmm. We have, like, over the phone, sight unseen.
Took a chance.
Took a chance and trusted him. So Glenn Thurston really helped our family. And then the Co reminded them of Floyd Conger.
Yeah.
So Glencoe became our prefix, which, and that's how we came about.
That's
so,
really cool.
So even with the Bain brothers, you know, you see the hitch now, and it's under the Bain brothers, but you've still kept the breeding prefix of Glencoe.
Absolutely.
That's,
that's where your history, and you see many families do that, and I'm so glad that's allowed.
Yeah.
Because we're not starting over again.
Yep. You know? You talk about growing, but there is something beautiful about holding on to the past a little bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, now it's cool when you see a pedigree. It's Glencoe, Glencoe, Glencoe. I mean, four or five generations deep.
We're four generations, and really within the past couple years, we've had our first Glencoe on the top line as the sire and Glencoe on the bottom line as a mare. That's a big accomplishment.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
There's some people that strive for that and they just never accomplish it, but.
No, and we talked last night, it takes generations to get some
patience.
Of this. And lots of patience. Like this isn't, we're in an instant gratification world. This is not an industry that really gives you that instant gratification.
It does not. You have to have fortitude and commitment. You have to have a passion for it, because if you don't, you won't be successful and you won't enjoy it. And you won't stay.
Yeah.
But as we're at our National Clydesdale show here, and I filmed I live streamed the junior driver cart. It was so emotional because I see that fortitude and commitment and passion. I saw kids mentoring their children.
And then you're seeing your grandkids in there doing the same thing.
Yes, and that's what it takes. Yeah. I mean, you have to have the passion for it.
Yeah, because nowadays, no kids want to work. So horses, breeding, owning, showing horses, it's all work. So unless they have that they get into it, they find a friend in it and just absolutely love it, they're never going to continue.
And they have to work.
Yeah.
Our rule on the farm, and I know I watch families here, and they have to work in order to have their day in the sun at the shows.
Yeah.
And that's what gives them that fortitude. And, you know, next time we're going to do this. So that's really cool.
I think Kale hit on something, the friend piece.
That's where it started for me. That's where I can speak from.
I remember going to the very first National Clyde show back when it was in Wisconsin. It was 1996. Andrew literally bitched the whole way down because he's like, this is a waste of our time. You should have beeped that. Not Andrew. I think we blew 10 tires on that trip. He was so mad. But I remember the very first kid who would be our friend was Ryan. He was the only kid that would be our friend. And people are like, who are those kids? Where did they come from? And he's like, they're actually nice kids. Because between Andrew and I, we won all the youth classes. And I'm like, well, that's not going to make us friends.
Yeah.
No.
But these are friends. It's like it's our second world. You only see them during the show season. Modern technology, you can keep track of people easy. But that whole Clydesdale world is a second world. It's like a bonus to our everyday lives.
But it's like I've always said too, it's weird because I've got cousins that live out in California, and when you're younger, you might see them once or twice a year. And it was that first day you'd see him, it was kind of awkward. You didn't really know what to talk about because you really haven't talked to him in a year. But you, like, we were kids, and I used to hang out with your son Logan, and we would get to a show, and you pick up right where you left off. It was never that awkward, what are you doing? Because we had so much in common that it was just natural and easy. And now some of my best friends are in the horses because they know the struggle. If you got a horse that's got a temp and you're up all night trying to cold hose it because Bantamy's not keeping it down, they know all that about you. So it's just natural.
You're a resilient group. And that Milwaukee, it was one of the classes I live streamed just this year, late at night. And I looked over, and there's just a pack of kids.
Yeah.
And there was a Stallheim kid and a Brooks kid and a Bain kid. And I put them on my live stream. I said, you have to understand, these kids have long days too.
Yeah.
But they are making the best memories.
Yeah.
The best.
And, like, I'll still, for till the day I die, remember rollerblading around Wisconsin State Fair. I mean, we'd wear the wheels off them, but you just never forget that.
Rollerblading before the scooters.
Yeah,
scooters are the nowadays.
We were way older than scooter kids. Way older. So speaking of you being secretary, how long were you secretary of the Clyde Association?
So I was the secretary. My mom was the secretary first.
Yep.
And then when I was a young girl, I just started helping her. My mom took on the secretary in the 70s, mid-70s, and I was still at home and still in school. And when we had a mailing or we had a newsletter, which we cut them on a stencil, probably never.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Which made me a really good typist because you don't want to make a, you know, mistake on a stencil. And the whole family would have to sit at the table and help with the mailings, right? So I was still in high school. My mom took this on. And so I was always involved. I always helped mom. And then several years later, when my mom decided, you know, it was time to slow up, she never, never used the word retired. She wasn't retired. We used the word transitioned. So when she transitioned out
she
of
went to
her
more
role,
part-time, and
yes,
you moved up in the full-time
and then it
kind
of flipped it.
Yep.
But we had it built up to where, you know, when mom first got it, it came from Maury Talene, was the secretary first, who, you know, famous Maury.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the day he came, he drove his truck in and he had like, there was a file cabinet in it and like two boxes of stuff. So mom put it in the upstairs bedroom and everything, of course, was done on pen and pencil, you mm-hmm. know, ledger sheets, membership, Rolodex rolls.
Yeah.
You know, and she did it part-time because there wasn't enough work to do it full-time. The newsletters, like I say, were cut on a stencil. You know, when it was time for a mailing, everybody got invited for a meal. But first, we're going to stuff all these envelopes. Is that kind of thing. So a long time.
So are you saying that you licked the envelopes that we got?
No, that was my mom. That was my dad's job. And that's when you had to lick stamps, too.
Yes.
They didn't come to press on.
They weren't already.
My dad always wore bib overalls. So, you know, he'd be at one end of the table, and we'd look down, and dad's got stamps stuck everywhere. You know, so it was a long time we were involved in the record keeping.
But you look at just your time into it, and from when you started helping your mom to the technology evolution that we got to by the time you were done is incredible.
It is.
To take all those paper records, enter them into, at the time we weren't using digital wars, it was actually,
oh, no.
I thought.
We didn't have a computer.
No, but at the end, we had a different system that actually liked better than digital wars, but it was, do you have to go back through and enter all those back genetic in?
And that's when the association committed more time to my role.
Yeah.
Logan was little,
and
so it was like in the late 80s, we did get a computer. You know, we went from the stencil machine to a copy machine. We went from a typewriter, and now we're going to have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Hinken's son-in-law wrote our first heavy horse program, and he came from Washington, and he was about 6'5", and we had it in one little bedroom up in the upstairs, and like, we put a little desk in the corner, and that's when they said, we have all this data entry. So the association they hired me to do that data entry.
Yeah.
But Craig came, and it was it was a grueling process, and it was imperative to get it correct.
Yeah.
Because that's where all of our stuff goes back to.
Yep.
So we had to get it right.
I didn't know. I guess I never realized it was Ed's son. You said that.
It was his son-in-law.
A son-in-law.
And he was a computer genius. Craig Heisga was his name, and he barely fit. He was a trooper. The three of us couldn't sit in the same room because, and he was the brain of the computer era, but he didn't really know how all the data was going to fit together.
Yep.
So we were the data gurus, and he was the computer guru. And there was much time just figuring out how it's going to work.
Yeah. Well, you make one input wrong, and then it goes wrong on 30 different papers.
Right. And then it wasn't just U.S. horses. We had to go back.
Oh, yeah. You're putting pedigrees of horses that might even been in the U.K. because you have to go that far deep back on the pedigree.
Right. So we went, our pedigrees go, three generations. So some of the back generations weren't as detailed and adequate as they should be because we searched to find birth dates or breeders or and the breeding part, looking up breeders and stuff wasn't what we see now.
No.
That it's traceable.
Yeah.
So it was a difficult process.
That's nuts.
How long did that take?
A long time. And I wish I knew how long, Christy. Yeah. Craig could tell us, and I could look that up, but it took well over a year, and then we published, many of you have that big blue book that you don't want to drop on your foot, and nowadays it's a ridiculous probably thing, probably some people use it as a doorstop, but I use it as a real marker because in the front of your blue stud book, which I don't have mine here at the show, it gives the dates of when it was compiled, and so we printed it just, I guess, because so many people weren't computer literate then.
Yeah.
And they wanted something hard to look at.
Yeah.
I even think in this digital age, though, I think there are still people who prefer hardbound books. I think there's a group that still gets excited about print publication.
Oh, I still get excited when the Draft Horse Journal or the Perchin News or the Clyde News or Sale Book. Like that, you still want to physically see it, touch it.
Well, I think we have a generation gap there. We're fortunate to have longevity in our membership and our breeders. And so you have the modern, this generation, but you still have that generation who wants to touch it and put it on their lap and read it and reflect upon it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie, when the sale catalog comes out in a PDF, it's nice to quick flip through it. It's not the same feeling as when you get it in the mail and you get to
highlighters.
Because I have those 27 colors that I want to use all the way through it.
Yeah, it is there. And I guess maybe that's, we're kind of an old-fashioned group of people.
Yeah.
But that's not bad.
Well, I don't think it's old-fashioned. I think we are just really deeply rooted in tradition.
We are.
We are old-fashioned, though. I'm going to disagree with you because we come to a fair and we're not sitting on our cell phones. We come to a show or sale. We're actually having communications.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I've gone to friends' places and everyone's sitting there texting, and I said, well, we're just going to play on our fucking phones all night, I'll just go home and text you. I don't need to sit around here.
Yeah.
But there's no one that talks anymore. And that's what I think we are old fashioned is because we all get here, we work, bust our butts. But at the end of the day, we sit down, maybe have a drink and shoot the shit.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we got hooked on that, on the horses.
Is it old fashioned or is it we actually understand proper communication?
Probably both, because I don't think nowadays people understand it.
Because to really communicate and connect with people, and this is going to be the leadership instructor in me coming out, there's a lot to learn here in these next few episodes. But you actually have to physically look at somebody. Eye contact is a big thing.
Oh,
nonverbals are a big thing to communication.
Hearing their inflections and how they're saying it.
Yes, because you can have a text or an email, and you can misconstrue it very easily.
Oh, yeah.
But if we're sitting like we're sitting right now looking at one another, that's a gift.
Yes.
And that's what we need to try to hold a little more sacred.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've been part of this for a long time and been a major spoke in the wheel of the Clyde Association. So what kind of trends, like, I guess I look at, like, bell-bottoms pants were really popular back in the 60s, and then they came back for a little bit, and now they're out of style again. But what kind of trends have you seen in the association? Are you thinking that the Clydesdale horse right now is kind of, like, going down into a little bit of a pitfall where, you know, prices aren't going to be that great, or we don't have a ton of new people? And then how long does that usually last when you've seen that, or to spike back up? Or where do you think the breed's at?
I think a huge thing for us right now is our economy. Because I look at this show and I know what we spend to get here. It's a lot.
Yeah.
So I think even since I've been involved, you know, the stud books, we used to print an annual stud book. And we prided ourselves in saying, okay, we registered this many horses, this many stallions, this many mares. I think it's always been a little bit of a roller coaster because of different economies. But I think it's imperative that we keep going. And I look at the people who have really kept it going, like our sales. Our sales have been up and down and up and down. I'll never forget Chip Shawana the year we had the $1 million sale. Mm-hmm. That was big for us. I mean, we went from selling our horses at Waverly Horse Sale, yeah, just a few, to taking a chance to branch out on our own. So I think you see ups and downs and ups and downs. What worries me about today is the economy. And it is, we stretch ourselves into so many different areas. And I tell you what, when you sit in the barn all night to have a foal, and there's a commitment to that maybe our world doesn't have that kind of commitment anymore. The world has changed. I would think our breed and the need for our breed and it to continue is the same, but we're bucking a world that isn't the same.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like what you just said, Kale. Like, we're different.
Oh,
and
you
need different skills.
We're nuts. We bust our butts to make money, and then we blow it all, or the most of our money, in the barn. Like you were saying, too. Like, you have a foal, and okay, we're already paying so much for hay, grain, feed, and then there's a problem with the foal. Then it's a vet work on top of it, and then it's like, oh yeah, I want to come show. And it's an example of, I'm not showing this year. I said, because I had a trouble with a mare. She had a high temp. No one could figure out what it was. The vet came, pulled blood. He actually overdosed the mare with 120 mLs of oxytetracycline, non-diluted, and she went into kidney failure.
Oh, boy.
So I had a $10,000 bill, and then I'm thinking, I want to go out and show horses yet? Like, no, I got to rein it back in. I'm still buying hay, and I got to rein it in. But that's 100% what it is.
Yeah, but you said the thing, you rein it in,
you don't get
quit.
Out. Yes.
Right? Yeah. So, like, every year at tax time, when we do our partnership taxes, it's like, oh, man.
Look at how much you
spent
all year.
How ignorant are we, really?
Yeah.
But the family says, what else would we do? It is a passion. And you have to have that for you to continue with it.
Yeah.
So my prayer is that once the public and we can promote what this breed is and how special they are, we'll continue with that. But we've got to work at it in our world today.
Do you have any ideas of how to, like, gain, like, we've had a couple new members recently, but there's not been an influx of a lot of new members. And if you look at the general age of our membership, they're not
Why
young.
Are you looking at me when you say the general age?
Well, I just...
Well, he looked at me first, but I gave him a dirty look. And then
he tried to look away. And you just happened to be one of that. No. But what do we do to entice new membership? Do you have any ideas for that?
So, yes, I do. I think that we need to be like our horses. We need to introduce our breed for what they are and get back to the bare basics. And we have to reach out to the general public and we have to say, this is so awesome. I think that if you look at the membership list and you look at a breeder's list and really take it apart, we've already done the groundwork on tradition and generations and the, you know, stay to it type people. But we have to sell it to other people because we're not going to, I mean, this is the most iconic draft horse in the industry.
It's the most, like, it's really the most widely known.
We have one of the most wonderful products to promote, but we have to touch people with them.
Yeah. And you guys started doing that on your own farm. You guys do like a open house, Clyde Week kind of thing at the farm.
We do.
But you're getting, like, I've seen pictures. I think Michelle was there and took pictures, but you're seeing a lot of faces that I guess maybe they're friends of yours, but I don't recognize in the pictures. And that's giving these people, these non-horse people, the opportunity to get an up-close view of what it is. And it's coming from a family. Like, I was just at Indiana State Fair helping someone, and the announcer's in there telling everyone in the whole crowd, in the whole Coliseum, the wagon costs $120,000. The harness is $75,000. And I said to Chip, I said, the guy just talked everybody out of wanting to get into this. Going to the farm where people know that we started out with a team, we had bio harness, and we built all the way up to this slowly and didn't jump in and pull a bunch of cash and then get scared back out.
Right.
That's what you're 100% right in what you're doing, because you're giving people the honest way of how you do it.
Well, and people are hungry for it. If you really do it in a promotional way, our open barn started with maybe 50 neighbors. Then we went up to maybe 250 people. The last open barn we had almost 2,500 people, which was almost a little scary.
Yeah, that's a,
you
know,
that's a lot of people.
And you don't, you know, they're all on your farm. And so this year we went to more of a new program, like a Clydesdale Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then they make reservations, so we know who's.
You can cap it.
Yeah, but in that amount of people, you may only have one or two potentials. But you don't know that until you subject the breed to them.
Yeah. So what could the association do, you think, to help more members do that? I think it should be self-explanatory, where a member would want more members in it, or a breeder would want more members in it, because it's more potentials to sell or show against. But what is there something that the association or the board could try to do to incentivize that?
You know, we all have a responsibility to that. I think it's not as a breeder.
Yeah.
You know, the association, what you kids are doing, something else that might come up. We all have a responsibility to carry that and promote. And it's going to take an army, because the world is so different that, you know, it used to be we were more personal and more, you know, it wasn't as hard to touch people. And the world was more trusting, and they were more open to it.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're in a different world. So I think, you know, we all have a responsibility. It's going to take an army to keep us going.
Well, I think one of the big things is we might need to embrace a little more collaboration over competition. Because I think for somebody new coming in, this is intense.
What?
You know, and you're trying to get into it. You're trying to learn. Some of us have been in it for five generations. We just know everything.
Yeah,
you know,
do.
And so that's, like, sometimes I think maybe we're a little intimidating because this is just so second nature to us that we sometimes forget that we have a responsibility to maybe mentor
some
of these new members too.
It's competition. We've reiterated that, but it's competition. I think competition, there's a little bit more money involved now. Things are costing more. People get a little bit more intense on it. And that's where I guess I got stuck on this, because I gained friends, and you're competitive with your friends, but you still help your neighbor out, or if someone gets into a pickle, like out here, everyone ran over and helped. And that's what it's all about. We just cannot get away from that. And I think sometimes you add more money, or there's more competition, or $100,000, and then it gets more cutthroat, and then not everyone's willing to help each other. And it's usually money driven, and which is so stupid, because all we're doing in this business is pissing money away, but we're going to fight over $50 in the halter class or a point for a classic series. And it's laughable.
I guess, you know, and over the years I've watched people come to the sale, and it's fun to watch what they buy, because people are going to buy what they like.
Yes.
Same with your involvement with the breed. You have to put into it what you want to get out of it. You might not want to spend a lot of money, you might not have a lot of money to spend, but you find a way. Like our family, your family, we go in the pasture and say, okay, this one is what we want to take and promote.
Yep.
And we don't have maybe many options.
No.
Some people have more options, but what we can't do is disappoint ourselves.
No, but you're a better trainer because of that. You can't just go out and buy another horse. You actually have to figure out a way to make that horse work.
It's a different feeling. And like I say, we got to get back to letting everybody do what they think is their priority or their importance.
Yeah.
But we have to make it easy for them. Mm-hmm. And we have to make it, if you think on your taxes, you're going to, this is a huge money-making industry, you know, people often say, is this a hobby or is this a business? And it's like, well, it's an expensive hobby.
It's a hobby I'm trying to make a business.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
and we don't.
How many succeed in that?
Nobody.
Yeah, but we can't scare people away by saying this and this and this and this is what it's going to cost.
No.
Because it doesn't have to be that way.
No. I mean, I can say my parents have never spent on a horse over $8,000.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My dad always said there is no horse worth like $10,000.
Yeah.
But that was in the olden day, you know.
But still, you can take a horse and then like we did, we bought a $3,500 roan mare, and then you just try to breed off of that to get something that you really want.
As long as you're satisfied, everybody can go to their own drum. They can, you know. But
you got to like what you're feeding.
What is important is we keep our breed around so people can have those choices.
Yeah. Another question I had for you is the Clydesdale, and I guess all the draft horses, they're the only breed that doesn't have a breed standard. And you were in the office a lot, and you've seen a lot of horses, you've seen a lot of sales. Is that something you think that would ever be good or bad, or what's your thought on it?
We have talked about a breed standard for years and years and years. And everybody has, like I say, they like what they like. And the breed has changed so much. If you look at pictures in the Clydesdale News from the 70s and 80s, and you look at pictures now, the breed has changed so much. I would like to say I think our breed has done really good to stick to the purity of the breed and the integrity of our breed. But as I looked at this show, and the Pertrans are here, and they're wonderful too, we have more characteristics to be come up with a typical breed standard.
Yes.
And probably the other breeds will disagree with that. But we have more color. We have hair. We have, you know, we
hawk
have...
Hawk action.
Hawk action. We have...
Yeah, we have hawk action.
You know, do we want Pertrans the old type that is more an old type Clydes? Or do we want the more modern, long neck, athletic...
Sail toppers.
Yeah. So a breed standard is a slippery slope because then you risk...
You're finding one or the other.
You risk what I talked about, people like and they'll do what they like. Mm-hmm. But if you set a too stringent breed standard, then you're going to be telling them what you think they should like.
Yeah, and then who's to define that?
Who's to define that?
Yeah.
So I think it's a struggle. I think we need to have guidelines. I think we need to help people because we have more diversity and more things going on now in our breed. But I think instead of concentrating on a breed standard, we need to concentrate on confirmation and genetics. People need help with genetics to get that confirmation we need.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to concentrate on that more, and people are going to come up with their own breed standards.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, I would never have a horse with a dark leg in my hitch. Well, you know, we do.
Yeah.
But that's our, I don't think you can dictate right now when we're kind of fragile on the wrong and the right of our breed. I think we need to educate.
Yep. Gotcha. Oh, what else do we have here? Oh, Christy had one other question too that she had written down prior, but do you have any ideas to like
how are we going to re-engage the members we have? Like a lot of times an association will say we need more new members, We were talking
earlier. We got to take care of the ones we have.
Yeah, you and I were talking earlier about, you know, like, we can't put so much on one person's shoulders. We can't say this person's going to fund this or this group is going to do this. How do we re-engage so it's like we have a lot of volunteers again?
Well, here again, that goes back on tradition. And even though I'm a lot older than you kids are, I've got this vision that we do have to think out of the box a little bit. I mean, and we owe it to our traditional people to keep, to support them. But we also need to be more open-minded, and we need to think of the little things that can help them out. And I think there's a whole lot of people out there that are excited about this breed, and we have only begun to tap into that.
Yeah.
What's been your proudest moment as a parent, as a breeder, as a within the Clydes of the Horse, as it references back to the horse, but what's been your proudest moment?
I have so many proud moments.
I know, but there's got to be one.
I have a childhood proud moment. I have a,
well, let's hear
you
it.
Know, as a parent proud moment. Like I said on my live stream today, as I watched my granddaughter ride with Logan in the cart, and he reached down and hugged her a little bit, you know, and I remember as a little girl being on the same wagon, you know, and my dad wiping my nose when I came into the ring at the Dairy Cattle Congress because it was cold and I was the second heat. And, you know, I think family and those moments are my proudest moments. Now we're four, you know, now I'm watching my grandkids, and it brings back those proud moments when I was young. And I think that's irreplaceable in the world.
Yeah.
There's no money. There's no, I mean, time can be a theft. Things can change. But I think we have to create proud moments. And we do it on an individual basis, what's important to us.
So I want to talk about Shipshewana last year. You talk about proud moments. Mm-hmm. And I know you're a daddy's girl, kind of like I am. But tell us about getting the wagon back. It was probably one that moved, I think it moved the whole barn to tears.
Yeah, well, Christy, you hit a very emotional thing there for me, and I was blown away by the generosity of some friends who made this possible. When Mr. Conger had his hitch, he had big horses, he had big geldings, and he had the big red wagon. And we have a picture in front of the farm with Mr. Conger and the big red wagon. And when Dad got sick, then we weren't hitching anymore. And my dad one day sold the big red wagon. And it was not a good day. It wasn't a good week. My mom was so upset with Dad, but you do what you do, right? And Charles Delzetti from Baraboo, Wisconsin, bought that wagon. And he just was a wagon collector. So he just put it in a semi-trailer and just had it. And, you know, over the years, I thought about that big red wagon and so many of my childhood pictures and memories. And I shared my sentiments about that big wagon because Bart Long is collecting
wagons. Yeah.
And he went to see Charlie Scalzetti. And he said, Kathy, I saw the wagon. He still has it. And I said, oh, I would just love to take my boys to see this wagon because it was part of my childhood, right? Mm-hmm. So last year at Shipshewana, Bart Long told me to sit in a chair, and he read the most beautiful thing, and friends got together, and he made a deal with Charles Scalzetti, and I know Bart, and I know it wasn't an easy deal to make.
Yeah, but those are the best parts, Zach, because he makes the relationship.
I know, and he's such a nice person.
Yeah.
And Eric Guyman bought two big geldings in the barn with that big red wagon, and it was a gift like no other. I mean, the sound of the wheels. If you ever see a old wagon.
Heavy wagon makes
heavy,
a difference. Heavy.
Our mares
will
die.
Yeah. They wouldn't make a lap.
They won't make
big.
A lap. We'll have to have a 10-horse hitch. But the wheels sound different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember getting up on the wagon, and as I stepped on the, you know, put my foot to get up on the wagon.
Just felt like
everything came back. It had the same cushion on the seat. that I used to hide my pile of rocks under, and Dad would say, okay, you hit that front lead horse, right? And Eric gave me the lines, and it was a gift that there's no thanking the people that did that. So the Big Ragged is home. It sits in the same garage it's at. Mr. Conger had it.
Cool.
The Bain brothers are going, this is our 20th year as our partnership. And I told the boys, I said, can we get a shot of the mares in the Big Red Wagon in front of the same farm that Mr. Conger had?
Yeah.
So
replicate that same picture.
It was an unbelievable surprise. It was just cool, Kristen.
It was so cool. As somebody who was there, it was cool. I think from our family perspective, it was one of those things where we went up to Bart and we're like, thank you for like reinstilling in us our faith in humanity
and friendships,
because right now we live in kind of a polarized world.
We do.
And it was one of those moments where it's like, the world isn't all bad.
No, and these friends that made it possible, there's no way to thank them. I'm like, you don't just write a thank you note for that, right?
Yeah.
But as I watched that night, as I was sitting by the stalls, different people came up and touched and remembered, and it was the ultimate gift.
Yes.
It's just, you can't give somebody memories like that, because they instantly came back to me.
Yes.
And I guess that's what drives our passion for all of this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, every show you go to, you're making those memories for your kids or your grandkids.
You are. Yeah. And like that old saying, it says, we thought we were just having fun.
Yeah.
Well, don't underestimate the memories you're making and how you're going to touch somebody by those memories. And that will keep us going. But we have to keep it real. We have to keep it special.
Yep.
Yeah.
So how do we get the announcer to talk about the dollar figure of those memories and those, like, they're intangibles. You can tell the crowd about the thousands of dollars we spend, but how do you tell people about the community you're about to join?
It's a family.
And it is a family.
You're going to fight like family. You're going to bicker like family. You're going to laugh. You're going to love like family. It's family.
Oh, we fought most of the time.
Yeah, and there is a competitiveness to us. I'm not going to lie about
that. No, there has to be.
Everybody
That's
likes
just driving
that
each other.
Day in the sun, right?
We all want our victory lap.
We do.
Unfortunately, I want to beat you to get my victory lap, but I still want to be friends at the end of the day. Like,
right, and we want to eat pizza and be happy for that person.
Yeah.
I think that the world needs that. I think they want that. I think that we need to tell the stories. We need to talk about our Clydesdale community. We're not going to get people to say, oh, gosh, I do have $200,000 laying around. I think I'll do that.
Blow it on some horses,
It's like we have to get them involved, and we have to get them to love and put their hands on a horse and love that.
Oh.
That's when you start making stupid decisions, right?
Yeah, especially women, because there's nothing better than two women that want the same freaking horse at a horse sale. Because there's no telling when.
Women just like winning the bid. It doesn't even matter if it's a horse sale.
Yeah. But when it's with an animal, then the emotion gets involved.
Oh.
They really loved it.
Yeah. But we need to tell the stories about staying up for three nights in a row and going in the stall, and it's like a sacred church.
Yeah.
You have this little baby, and granted, we are a business and an industry of very highs and very lows.
Oh, yeah.
When you're on a high, there's nothing higher than being there. When you're on a low and you lose a horse or you lose a filly, you know, a baby or the mare in the foal, those lows are really low, but then you turn back to your community.
And they bring you right back up.
Yes. When I was in the office, I would have a person call and maybe just break into tears.
Yeah.
All they wanted to do was share their sorrow. And we all get it when that happens. But we've got to get back to that personal. Even though the world might be different,
we have to maintain it.
We can't afford to be different.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes us special. Just the draft horse community in general is, we still want to connect with people. And I feel like our association is trying to go very digital. Just, we want to be efficient, but sometimes the most efficient thing isn't actually the most efficient thing.
we have to be efficient, and we have to keep the integrity of our records and our breeding and our all of that. But in becoming very digital, and I'm old-fashioned, I'm going to admit I'm old-fashioned, but I think we have to also keep this personal touch and community and networking and communication. We can't do it all in the modern way, because we are in a generation gap. I mean, Dan Jones isn't going to go to his email and answer that he's coming to my birthday party.
No.
You know,
he'd say yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a struggle, and it's a challenge all in one. You know, it might be easier to do it that way, but I think we have lost some of our personal touch, and I think that's sacred. I think we have to look back in the rearview mirror enough to hold on to what we prioritize, and then we have to look in the windshield, but we have to combine both of them.
The basics of marketing is to really promote the things that are special and unique, and I think if you're looking for an association or a group of people to join, right now I think people are craving human interaction, human connection, because everything is digital.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The thing that's special is the human part.
It is. And if you have a group of people, whether it's a club or an association or an individual that's trying to make a difference, that's where it is. I mean, we just have to keep that personal touch, because our horses are a personal breed.
Mm-hmm. So one last question I guess I had written down is, so the Classic Series is a big, big discussion. A lot of people like the Classic Series, but you go to these all breed shows and tens that the Clydes, I think, get easily put down because they're, you know, someone might like the front end of a Percheron, or maybe the action in the front of a Percheron, or the power of a Belgian behind or something like that. But Clydes is really at the bottom. What do you tell somebody that's new that wants to maybe get into Clydes that we still have the foundation of it, or we haven't lost the breed integrity or the power of the hind end of a horse? What would be your suggestion to join the Clyde Association versus the Belgian and Percheron? More of a family atmosphere, or just the horse itself?
Well, you have to look at the horse. There is a reason why there's different draft breeds.
Yeah.
And they're all different. The Belgians are different, the Percherons are different, the Clydes are different. And when you start competing against one another, you have to recognize those differences. And then again, it's a personal choice. Okay, this is what I want, or this is what I want. I think the Clydes are different.
Mm-hmm.
So where I like to see them all compete together, a judge is going to have a hard time with that, because you're judging, you know, so many different breeds, mm-hmm. and they all have their strength. And yes, like the Clydes might be down the road, but they're still stellar Clydes, like they're stellar Belgians and Percherons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard thing.
You just got to really love what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to pick what your passion is. If you want a Percheron hitch that, like, I look in awe of them, and I Belgians too, these hitches have gone way, way above what I had growing up.
From when we were in the 90s to now, you look at the evolution of it. It's incredible.
And I think the Clydes have too, as Clydesdales. They're not, you know, they're not Percherons. Yeah. They're not Belgians. We're different breeds.
But we haven't lost our integrity yet.
No, I don't think we have. We're lower in numbers, so our choices are, you know,
less.
We don't have as many horses. And so, you know, we kind of get on the end of the stick that way too.
Yeah.
But when I look at the placings for the Classic Series, I try to thank individual breeds. And, you know, people used to call the Clydesdale office and say, we want a draft horse, but we're not sure which breed. And clearly I would, you know,
push them towards the Clydesdale.
Yeah. The Clydesdale breeders. But go to a show and see what you like, because you're spending your money and you have to spend it on what you like.
Yeah, or you'll be out of it.
But I think the Classic Series, I think we just need to be careful that we individual lies that we are different breeds.
Yeah. It was really cool. The other day, I came down here to look at some horses for a customer of mine, and it's south of here. And anyway, I went to his place, and he's a Percheron guy, but he's been to a couple Clydesdales, and he said, he was at this Iowa State Fair the day before I went down to his place, and he said it was incredible. He said he walked through the barn, and the Percheron people will say, "Hey, how are you? You know, do you have anything in the barn?" But it's like they talk to you, and they really wouldn't. They're just talking to you. It's not like they were really caring about his answer, he said. And then he said, I walked down to some Clyde aisles, and he said, they're pulling out their phone. They're wanting to show me this, or this is what they've been doing all summer, or this is what their kids have been doing, and showing pictures. And he said, you felt like you were a part of their family. And he said, I've been in the Percheron industry for my whole life. Grew up with Percherons. And he said, I walked through the state I live in, walked through the fair, and he said, and I don't have that connection. He said, it's just incredible from going to a couple Clydesdales. He said that I feel like I have more rapport and more connection with the Clydesdale members or enthusiasts than he does the Percheron.
Well, so he's wanting to buy Clydes. Yeah, and part of that is we're a smaller community.
Yeah.
I mean,
But we actually care,
yeah.
I think.
And I think there are people in the other breeds that care. I think in all of the breeds, sometimes I think competition isn't. We get carried away with that.
Without a doubt, yeah.
You know, and we all do because we all like to win.
Yeah.
That's like the frosting on our cupcake.
Yep.
But I think because we're small and the world is big and the classic series, the Belgians and the Percherons do better than our breed. But I think we have to educate the people why they do better.
Yeah.
And you know, the Percherons and the Belgians have generational families too.
Yeah.
And they have people who care just as much. But if you go to a big city or a smaller town, sometimes the feeling's different.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know how to change that other than just to continue who we are and come in at, we need to do more. We need to do
open that door
more.
Up
we all need to do more.
Yep.
And I know that comes with time and it comes with money, but we are an industry that has so many talents that I think if we join together, we can make a difference.
Completely
for
agree.
The breed.
It is nice to know, though, that we have a reputation about really caring.
Yeah, it's cool to hear.
Because I think if you're going to join an association, you're coming in, you're paying dues to be part of a group of people. Wouldn't you want to know that you actually matter to that group of people? Like, that's what's heartwarming about what you just shared, Kale, is we're doing a good job. We're not just talking the talk. I think that example is one of those where we're walking the walk.
Right. And you have to be
willing
to
engage. We're trying, like, we know we have to sell our breed. We know we have to educate. It's nice to know that we've got
just
some members.
Just us being authentic is helping that. I thought that was cool.
Right. My mom was a big person that she tried to treat everybody the same, even though we're all walking a different path.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important, too. If somebody chooses to do something different with their horses, it's their choice. But we're all in the Clydesdale breed together.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a big advocate for that, and that's how the world was a little bit then, but you know, I do think we have to treat each other as equals and have respect for what the other person's doing, and at the end of the competition, we all go out and we go home with what we like and what we love, and we're friends.
Yeah. That's why I've always told people if they want me to go look at a horse for ride, like, well, you got to like it. I'll give you my opinion.
Right.
But at the end of the
day,
you're going to be the one getting up at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. or 4 a.m.
That's
and
right.
going to bed at 10 p.m. after you get done doing chores. You have to like it.
Well, and you have to. That was always one thing Mom and I both asked people when they called the office, what do you want to do with it?
Yeah.
Some people just want to look at it in
Lawn
the
ornament.
Pasture.
Yeah.
Some people want to start a breeding program, and there's a little more thought into that. Some people want to ride now. Some people just want to hitch. We have to find we have to scope in on new people and what they want to do with it so we can help them. We need to mentor them.
Yeah.
I
think we need to look at it as we have to help them with their path instead of pushing them down ours.
You can't.
It's tough for a new person. Say you get into it and you go to the sale and someone warms up next to you like, oh, you know, I'll help you out. But then they're gonna try to sell you something. Like, you got to almost team up with somebody that says, I'm not going to sell you a damn thing. And I'm not going to sell you my friend's horse. I'm going to teach you what you need to know. But how do you find that person? Like, if you're new into the whole group of people, you don't know boo. How do they go in and find that?
Well, I do think there needs to be a mentorship program.
I would completely.
Yeah. I mean, I have a personal interest in that find the right people with the right, and you know, we're good people. There are people who might
take advantage of it.
Yeah, there might. But that's how the world is.
Yeah.
You know, if you buy a new car, if you buy, but I think we need to get personal enough that we seek what that person really wants. We've had people come to the farm. Mm-hmm. We have nothing for them because they have a different need or they have a different goal of where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. They've still come to the farm.
They can learn.
They've looked at different horses, they've looked at ages, they've looked at genetics. Whatever we can do to help that person find their niche in our industry, that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do like that idea of a mentorship program. It was one of those things that came up at the sale this spring because I think we had some overseas buyers that had some translation issues. And it would have been nice to have a couple people on hand to say, you know what? We're going to pair you up with this person that's going to help you with these conversations.
It should be a group. And then that group could be policing itself saying, hey, you're not trying to just sell this because that's really, it should. That would self-police it where to the point it would feel like everyone just backs off because, no, I can't sell them this because they want it for this and that's really not a riding or Western pleasure horse. Or you could, that group could kind of, if you got a diverse group, it'd be a wicked cool idea to do that.
Yeah, it would be. It's a big job.
Yeah.
It is.
It's a big job. Some people just don't want to stick their necks out to do that kind of job.
Yeah.
But it's, we've got to do more of that type one-on-one.
Even when I was a kid, there was a group called Cashmere Clydes. They went and bought a mare at the Clydesdale, brought, I think, $32,000. They bought one of the highest selling things. Rex Mann drove for him 1 year at Wisconsin. She was dead last in the halter class, dead last in the gutter class. And I remember them because they bought the mare that April. They showed her at Wisconsin State Fair, and they were done and sold and out of it. So they went to the sale. Someone told them this is the mare to buy, and it wasn't really the mare for them. And they were, here was a person that was spending, and that was back in the early 2000s, spending big money, and then they were out.
And we've seen that time
over
and time again.
Over again.
And some of it is because that was their priority.
Up. Yep, they got caught up.
You know, they,
yep.
And if, and it, maybe they had their own goals that weren't attainable as fast as they want them to be. And we all go through that.
Yeah.
And the new people go through that. And then we get a bad rap because, well, it's kind of like, okay, I have the champion stallion. I'm going to breed it to the champion mare, and I'm going to get a champion filly.
No. You're going to get a lawn ornament.
So nothing in life is guaranteed.
No, we just said with Dave and Linda the other night, I said you can go to Walmart and see two fugly people, and they got a cute kid. And
you see two
really attractive people, and they got a mud of a child.
But I think that as mentors, we can't promise that to people. They are animals.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a lot of luck.
Yeah. And so it's okay if you don't win. But if that's what the person wants to do, then that's their priority.
Yep.
And some people, we all have different priorities.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. We've seen a lot of come and go in it because we do invest money into it. And it's not just the money. It's the time and the personal commitment. And if you don't feel like you're getting out of it enough to warrant what you're putting into it, it's like anything else in life, then you're going to quit.
Yeah.
But
and then you add the economy that you were talking earlier. If I'm only half into this, and now everything's 40% higher, it's easy for me to say, I'm really out of this.
Yeah. Or you just, some people have had too many disappointments. They've had some really, really hard luck, and they look at it, and we've all been there. We've all lost that special one and a freak thing and think, I am done with this. Yeah. Why would I want to do this?
Yeah, I was going to sell everything and buy a boat.
See?
Yep.
And then we'll all be sitting on a boat thinking, I wish I had Clydesdale horses back.
No, I'd just be thinking,
no,
I'm saving
sure
money today out here.
If it's Kale, the boat is sitting in the water and he's swimming around it. Like, can you really see him sitting on a boat?
I don't know.
It is
trying. But then you see your friends again, and you get re-inspired in it, and you start talking, and then you talk about memories and the stories and the remember when, and then you get back out in the barn, and it's like, all right, you know, I'm looking at this horse in a different light now. I gotta get re-inspired, and it is tough. But your friends, the people in this industry, prop you right back up.
It's what makes us special.
Yeah.
Well, because what they'll do is they'll tell you a story about a time when they lost everything.
They have even worse than you did,
yep,
and they're still here, so get your ass back out there and do it.
Yeah, I don't know that they're giving you hugs. I'm pretty sure they're giving you, like, the tough love, suck it up, it could be worse.
That's what you need.
And sometimes you need that.
Yep.
Yeah. You need the tough love.
Or remembering that it's going to get better.
Yeah.
It doesn't stay bad forever.
No. Life, and that's how life is. So these horses are big. Great big gentle giants that teach us so much about life.
Yeah.
You know, on our farm, kids are learning every day from them, and I still learn from them. But you have to have a special connection, and we have to keep that in front of people's faces. We still get goosebumps when we see the Budweiser Clydesdales, and we have a barn full of them.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's that we got to sell our breed as being special, just like the Belgians and Percherons are doing with their breed.
That's cool.
Yeah.
This has been awesome. Thanks, Kathy, for sitting down with us.
Well, I could talk forever.
Yeah, we all could.
And there's so many. I appreciate you and your willingness and priority in telling some of the stories, because that's going to lead us to real. And that's what we have to be, is real.
Yeah, absolutely. No one can misconstrue the words when it's coming out of your mouth, but I can put my foot in my mouth all the time.
They can.
Well, if they listen to it and type it out and read it, maybe they can. But that's what we talked about one of the other episodes. It was Jonesy, and he said that, you know, that there's always some politics, and then there gets to be some waves in the association. And I said, I think a lot of that's due to communication. We were just talking earlier, text can be misconstrued, and now it's social media, it's texting, it's phones, but no one calls each other anymore. But no one sits down and has a conversation where you can see the inflection. So I wanted to get this together. We wanted to get old-timer stories, some funny stuff recorded, and some true, like, history of the breed and where it kind of came up. And when we were talking about that, I said to Christy, I said, you really got to sit down with Kathy.
Yeah, like, thank you.
Well, we do. I mean, you've been in this your whole life. You've seen the ups and the downs and been the biggest spoke in the wheel in my generation for it. So why wouldn't we start here?
Thank
so this
you.
Is going to be one of several interviews.
And I think that I would allow it, and I'd like to do a reflection of where we have been, where we are now, and where we're going.
That's Christy's whole motto for the show.
Yeah.
To a T.
Yeah, she didn't tell me that, but it is true, you know. The past is what has created us
shaped
and made
us
and shaped us. The present is what we're prioritizing now, and that's going to lead to our future. So if we don't reflect on those three things, then our breed's in trouble.
Yeah. How do you think, I guess one last thing too, the youth. Do you think the next generation here is, from you just watching them in involvement, do you think that we're in good, like the Clydesdale horse is in a good spot?
I think we are.
Okay.
I think we are. I looked at that. I keep going back to this CART class.
Yep.
But I'm, being my age, I have the privilege of seeing some of the past, you know, some of those parents out there with their kids. So I looked at that class, and yes, a lot of it is generational. There were a few new ones out there. And so we've got to keep encouraging that. And you see a new person, go up to their child and say, we are so proud of you and what you did today.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah.
You know, I think our future is bright. I don't know what the world's going to do to us. You know, I don't know if our kids are going to be able to afford or where their paths are going to take them.
Yeah.
But I think we just need to keep doing what we're doing.
If you can breed and raise six Clydesdale horses successfully, I think we're pretty resilient people as far as the economy.
Yeah.
We are.
Well, I think we'll find a way.
Yeah.
I do think we will find a way. Like you said, we might not go and buy horses. We might have to raise some horses.
Might be
horses.
Five generations of raising them to get a good one.
Yeah.
But as long as you have the drive and passion and desire to do it,
well,
and like you said from the get-go, don't quit.
Well, and it's up to us to teach our kids. Okay, I live streamed that whole class, one of my favorite classes of this show. And I had a granddaughter in there.
Yep.
She didn't win first. But I tried to say every kid's name, and then little Emma won first. And I'm like, she has the smile of an angel. Every kid deserves that. We have got to keep supporting all of our kids and each other.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's cool because I see the kids out there, and I spent a lot of time talking this morning. I'm not going to lie. I actually got kicked out of the senior showmanship class for talking.
By your daughter?
No, by the judge.
Oh.
He's like, you can have social hour in the corner.
Well, good for him.
All the whip people need to leave. But just watching the kids in line, building each other up. Because he asked him a question in the senior class. He asked him a question. And the first one we get back. And then the next one we get back. And then it's like, well, what did he ask you? And what answer did you give? And how did you, okay, I think we did okay. Like, I think, like, they're in the lineup, supposed to be showing, but still building each other up, going, I think we're going to be okay. I think we're going to be fine.
But you see the youth card classes at different shows and other breeds, and all these kids are like, good luck, so-and-so, and the horse is half running off. They're so excited to say good luck to their friend. We just need to look at that as adults.
We do.
Stay focused.
We need to.
But do the same damn thing.
Don't let the horse run away as you're saying good luck to your friend.
We do kind of have to go into this with the innocence of a child.
Yeah.
If we can learn from anything,
from them
we
on
can
that.
Learn from our kids.
Yeah.
Like, they get camaraderie. I mean, we have camaraderie, but they don't have any blinders to their camaraderie.
No, we're so focused on, if I pluck one more hair, if I do this one more time.
Kale is focused on plucking one more hair.
It's everybody. It's not just that, but you get so focused on that you lose, and that this whole thing's kind of gone about that, but you lose sight of why you got in this. You got in this because you love the people.
Right.
The people were your best friends, and you still wanted to, you know, whoop up on them, but you still wanted to sit there and have a beer and congratulate each other.
Well, and you love the breed, too. Like I say to the kids on the farm, you know, feed them. They'll fall in love with you if you feed them, right? So a lot of those children out there today, like my granddaughter was driving her special connected mare, you know. So if we got to get back to that. We got to get back to the connections and that feel-good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't feel good when competition and politics take over. It's always going to be there.
Oh, yeah. You're never going to get away from it.
It's always going to be there. And that's why people just have to choose what makes them happy.
Yeah.
And not
worry about the placings.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like to win ribbons. I'm not going to lie. It is fun to win because it's like
a rush.
A rush of all your achievements. And, hey, I raised that mare, and she, but like at the halter, we raised a mare and shared her, sold her off, and she was best of breed. You know, it's, you have to pick and choose what's going to put the feather in your own cap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the coolest thing when you go out there and you win the blue ribbon and your blood, sweat, tears, and it just feels like, fuck, it was all worth it.
Yeah.
And that inspires you to win seventh place ribbons for another 2 years or whatever and try again, you know?
Remember that one time?
Time we got that one blue ribbon?
But that's you're doing it for that feeling. You're not doing it for a blue ribbon. You're doing it for that rush of energy and that
Or that $10 that you won?
Yeah.
Or, you know, we always said, gosh, we want to get second in the six because we can't afford the pizza after we've spent all, you know. So that's a joke. But
I know. But half the time, if you add up the pizza, it's like, really, second wouldn't have been that bad. But to me, that's just the coolest thing. We can joke around about it, we can laugh about it, and I just want more of that. I want more stories.
Yeah, we need the stories, because we need to know, like any family, where we've been, where we come from, and able to put the best foot forward to go into the future. So I think that's a priority to me.
Cool. Well, this has been great, Kathy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks
until we get to the next episode, because you're going to come back. We got more to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to dive in a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, both feet.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Cool. Oh, that was fun.
Sorry for the warm ears.
Yeah. But, like, there is a world out there. Well, what do you think?
I loved it.